اوكي بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. We talked about the migration of the prophets, peace be on him. Now, just a look at the Yathrib, which later on became Medina Sun Nabi, on the arrival of the prophets. What type of society and what type of structure that society had. Now, Yathrib was an old town which had been repopulated at a comparatively recent date. It was very old when the, you remember we said that the Qahtani Arabs from Yemen, they migrated to the north of Jaziratul Arab, and they were somehow located near the Yathrib. And Jews found the place. It was an oasis, of course, in the desert, so it was a very highly demanded type of piece of land which people would have liked to live in. So the Jews had come there, these Arab tribes had come there. It was a fertile, some sort of island in the desert. And that's why even some of the caravans going to Syria, they preferred to come and stay in Medina, although it was off the path, to stay in Medina for a while. And also it was an agricultural settlement as well, and it has various tribal groups in it, as we discussed before that. Now, some believe, which I don't think is right, but some you come across this in some books, that the area had originally been cultivated by pioneering Jewish settlers, and there were main Jewish tribes there, which were very powerful in the city, of course. The main Jewish tribes were Banu Qurayza, and Banu Nadir, and Banu Qaynuqa, with all of whom the Prophet had a battle, of course. And originally, of course, they were very peaceful. When they saw that Prophet is very independent in his faith, because they thought this is a faith which is very similar to ours, and we might probably somehow absorb the Prophet in ourselves. And then with the help of this Prophet, we can fight Christians, we can fight other Arabs. So originally, they were very receptive and very peaceful with the Prophet. But later on, of course, things turned to be otherwise. There were some other, of course, smaller tribes, such as Banu Tha'laba and Banu Zurayq, which were not very considerable, of course, in Medina. Interestingly, Maxim Robinson and Karen Armstrong, they mention that the Jewish name for Yathrib was the Aramaic Medinat. Now, why they had called it Medinat? Probably because it was in their books that this is Medina Sun Nabi, where the last prophet is going to come. And that's why many scholars mentioned, that's why these Jews had actually migrated to this place, which was called in their books, which of course are not available for us now, because when we talk about their books, we shouldn't confuse it with our present Torah or Bible. They had their own version of Bible, and that's why Quran gives references to their Bible that we cannot find it now. So in their version of Bible, there was a mention of Medinat, because the Arabic name for it was Yathrib. So they used to call it Medinat in the knowledge that this is going to be in future Medina. Well, of course, after the migration, the city Yathrib was called Madinatun Nabi. Now, some other Jewish tribes lived north of Yathrib, in Khaybar. Now, they certainly had not migrated to the place because of the news, because the news was about the Medina. They had found the place very accommodative and comfortable to live in. Of course, this Khaybar was a bunch of castles. They had seven castles in which different Jewish tribes in Khaybar lived. And also there was Fadak, and other Jewish settlements like Tayma' or Wadi al-Qura. I think I have a map here which puts some of them. If you look at the final slide, you see Medina and you see Badr, you see Khaybar up north, and you see Tayma' upper north. In a way, they had chosen the northern part of Arabia to live in. Alaykum as-salam. There is not, Fadak is not shown on this map, but it is towards the east of Khaybar. A bit closer to Medina, but it's towards the east of Khaybar, Fadak. And, in of course, there were two main tribes.
I have a question I need to ask, and to be clarified. Because the Westerners usually say that Islam was spread with the sword. Now, the Jews were staying in Medina before Yathrib, before Prophet migrated them. So basically it was their city, they were there. And then the Prophet and the others came Muslims, they became Muslims. So who was, did they offend the Prophet first, and that's why the Prophet
goes
for them, or
we will discuss this, but the point is, it wasn't their city. They were minority in the city, despite the enormous number of Jews there, especially in the three tribes that I mentioned. Still, they were minority in the city. The majority were the Arabs, the original Arabs of Aus and Khazraj.
They were residing there. They were there.
Yeah, but when Prophet went to Medina, the whole Aus and Khazraj converted to Islam. And they were the ones who decided who should be the leader of Medina. Now, we'll come to that. Prophet actually concluded a treaty with the Jews there. And then there were numerous and repeated breach of that treaty by the Jews. And that's why then Prophet started to fight against them. Now, some other smaller Arab tribes who had been there before them were closely connected with the Jews before Aus and Khazraj, of course. Aus and Khazraj, they didn't need to have a pact with the Jews because they were very strong themselves. Now, of course, you can imagine, Prophet has entered the city, there is a tribal system there, and then there are Jews. Different tribes, Jewish tribes. Those Arab tribes living there, they were also fighting against each other. So the first thing that Prophet should have done is to make a sort of agreement between all these groups, a pact, and something which would bring everyone under one system of law. And this is the first thing that the Prophet did. And it's interesting, we start right from here to see how did Prophet, the Prophet, peace be on him, manage the situation in Medina, then in the battles and all these things. We realize that he was a very, very great statesman. He was not the Prophet that we know in Mecca, of course. Completely different Prophet now. In Mecca, of course, Prophet was just like Jesus Christ. I mean, he didn't have any power, he didn't want to get the power there. He only sought protection. Here, now that he has protection, and he is given the leadership. Of course, he did not take the leadership by force. He was given the leadership. Then we see how capable a leader the Prophet is. Right from here, when we start, until the end of his life, when he had almost 70 battles. And 70 battles in the course of 11 years is what? About one battle every 6 weeks, isn't it? And just imagine to organize all these things, to decide where to start a battle, where to conclude a peace treaty. It's amazing. I mean, a short career of leadership of the Prophet, 11 years, and then you see the fast current of events and different upheavals. It's really amazing. How did Prophet manage all these things? Single-handed, of course, with those tribes who were rival against each other, with the Jews there, not only in Medina, up north, around the city, with the very, very bitter animosity that they had, or they assumed later on, against the Prophet. Now, The first thing the Prophet did in Medina was to conclude a pact between Muslims and the Jews and everyone who lived in Medina. So all tribes living in Medina. The important articles of the pact, as Ibn Ishaq reports, are as follows. Muslims and Jews live in Medina as one nation. This was something that Prophet emphasized. As one nation. We are all citizens of Medina. And there's no difference between a Jew and a Muslim. Secondly, Muslims and Jews can freely practice their respective faiths. Now, this is before the rule about Ahlul Kitab coming and Jizya. Those rules came after the Jews broke and breached this treaty. Otherwise, at the beginning, they were just equal citizens. There was nothing there to somehow differentiate between them. If any of the two parties are attacked by an outsider force, the other party should support them, provided they are not aggressors. So if the Jews were attacked, Muslims were bound to support them and to protect them. If the Muslims were attacked, Jews were bound to protect them, provided that attack didn't come following an aggression. Of course, if the Jews had made an aggression to someone and they wanted to retaliate, the treaty doesn't include that, and vice versa. If the Muslims had done an aggression and Jews wanted to support them, they were not bound to do that. Now, you will see how this Bani Nadir and Bani Qurayza and Bani Qaynuqa behaved. I mean, it was in complete violation of the treaty. The treaty which was signed very freely by all tribes. If Medina is attacked, both parties have the responsibility to defend it, because they are the citizens. A peace treaty could not be concluded could only be concluded by the agreement of both parties. In a way, the Prophet is given an equal platform to Jews, although he was the leader. But he said, if I want to conclude a peace treaty with someone, or if I want to involve in a pact with another tribe, you should agree. If you want to do that, we should agree. So, very, very fair type of article here. Medina is sacrosanct, and no bloodshed is allowed in it. And sacrosanct here, it means haram. Just like Mecca was haram, Prophet said, Medina, and there was, of course, a boundary declared or determined for it, was haram. It means that anyone inside Medina doing any bloodshed would be punished severely. And the final arbiter in any dispute will be the Prophet. This was, of course, the arbiter was chosen by the Jews as well, that the arbiter would be the Prophet himself. Now, however soon the Jews and the hypocrites started their provocative moves. Now, of course, everything was very good and rosy at the beginning. But then they started to see how Prophet is attracting people, how he's successful in his leadership. Then they started to go into some sort of evil thoughts. And it's very interesting. I suggest that you recite the first 100 verses of Surah Baqarah. It was actually revealed at this juncture that when the Jews and hypocrites started to do some mischief and started to go against the treaty, and of course, the beginning of Surah Baqarah, that وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَن يَقُولُ آمَنَّا بِاللَّهِ وَبِالْيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ وَمَا هُم بِمُؤْمِنِينَ. There are some among you who say we believe in God and the Day of Judgment. They are not believers. يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهِ. They deceive Allah and they deceive the mu'minun. But they are deceiving only themselves. And then it categorizes these munafiqun into some category. Then it attends to the Jews. يَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلِ اُذْكُرُوا نِعْمَتِيَ الَّتِي أَنْعَمْتُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَأَوْفُوا بِأَحْدِي أُوفِ بِأَحْدِكُمْ. And then this treaty is mentioned somewhere in Surah Baqarah. I do not remember the verse now. الَّذِينَ يَنْقُضُونَ أَحْدَ اللَّهِ مِنْ بَعْدِ مِيثَاقِهِ. It might be a reference to this pact, which was of course Ahdullah, because Prophet was Prophet of God, he made the treaty, they started to violate the treaty. Now, okay, we come to the battle with the Jews.
When was the pact made? Within a year or within 6 months? Within 3 months?
Within a year. It was even before the that pact of brotherhood. So it was within 6 months that the pact was made. Because the brotherhood was in the 8th month, so this was just within 6 months that the pact was made. And Surah Baqarah is revealed on the 2nd year of Hijrah, before Badr. And especially these parts of the Surah. And therefore, they started their provocations just after the treaty was concluded. Maybe towards the end of the 1st year, they started to do those unsuitable acts. Now, then we come to the battles, of course. As I said, about 70 battles took place. When we say battles, some of them were really excursions. They were not battles. Just a dispatch was sent somewhere and they came back without fighting. It was just a show of force in some occasions. Hmm? They were not, no, even not skirmishes. They were military excursions. They just went out to show that we are present, we are around. That was all. Especially the first few excursions of dispatches of men like Hamza and others. It was just showing that we are present, we are here. Now, we have two terms for these battles, Ghazwa and Sariya. Now, Ghazwa means battle, of course. But technically, it has become accepted that in Islamic history, when we talk of a Ghazwa or Ghazu, as you find it in some books, it means the battle in which the Prophet himself took part. Of course, there were many ghazwas, but not in all of them Prophet personally went to battlefield. He was leading. In 10 or 11 of these ghazwas, Prophet personally went to battlefield and fought. It was not so always the case that Prophet was leading or commanding and staying back. In some of those, especially in Uhud, for example, the Prophet was injured. He was the hub of the battle. And Amirul Mu'mineen mentions that whenever the battle, the fight became very, very hot and intensive, then we all sought refuge to Rasulullah because he was the bravest of all when he came to the battlefield. Well, this is something said by Amirul Mu'mineen, who was the bravest of all. He says, "Kunna idha what's the expression? Idha hamiya al-watis." كنا إذا حمي الوطيس or كنا إذا حمر الحرب when the fight became hot red hot إذا حمر البرد ال what's the expression التجأنا برسول الله something like this I think yeah we sought refuge to Rasulullah because when we went around him the type of battle that he showed was magnificent. Now, then those battles in which the Prophet did not take part, he just dispatched a group, was called Sariya. Sariya simply means a dispatch of force, of troops. So, sometimes he dispatched some troops to go somewhere and fight, or to have a show of force, and this was Sariya. And sometimes Prophet himself took part in the battle, and that was Ghazwa. They say that number of the Ghazawat of the Prophet were 26 or 27, the battles in which Prophet himself was present. As I said, in about 10, 11 of these Ghazawat, he himself involved in the battle as well, engaged in the battle. Number of Sariyas are about 38 to 40, and some sources have mentioned up to 60 Sariyas, but maybe they just regarded every small mission of, for example, 5 or 6 soldiers sent by Prophet somewhere to come back. They regarded that as a Sariya, and that's why the numbers differ very greatly. Now, in the first and the beginning of the second year, in the first year and the beginning of the second year of Hijrah, the following excursions, they were really excursions, they were not battles, took place. This is before Ghazwatul Badr. Now, first Sariyah. There were different Sariyah. Sariyah of Hamza. Sariyah of Ubaidah ibn Harith. Sariyah of Sa'd ibn Abi Waqas. It should be Sa'd. Sa'd ibn Abi Waqas. Now, what was all these excursions about? It was about somehow threatening people of Mecca that let's come and be friendly. Because we have your throat under our crutches. And that was the root of caravans. So, in a way, on the way of several caravans going from Mecca to Syria and coming back, Prophet sends these excursions. They show that they are there. In some instances, there were skirmishes or swearing at each other, something like that, exchanging some words. But they just showed that they were there. However, they didn't go in great numbers. For example, Hamza went with only 30 people to just show their force to a caravan of 300 guards. So they didn't really want to fight. They didn't want to confiscate anything. They just wanted to say that we are here, be careful. And somehow to soften the position of people of Mecca, who were very hard on Muslims, especially those who had not been able to migrate. This was probably the purpose of the Prophet sending these men to just show themselves to the caravan coming from Mecca and going back to Mecca. The Ghazawat in this first year and beginning of the second year, Ghazwatu Waddan, Ghazwatu Bawad, and Ghazwatu Ushayr. Again, all these Ghazawat were going, Prophet went with troops just to show himself to the guards and the leaders of the caravans. This Ghazwatu Ushayr is important because this is the same caravan that was going to Syria, which on its way back was threatened by Prophet, and then Ghazwatu Badr took place, the Battle of Badr. So this is the caravan which Abu Sufyan was leading to Syria. When the caravan came back, of course, Prophet sent more force to go and really confiscate this, because news came that everything in Mecca was confiscated by whatever the Muslims had. So Prophet said, now we can go and confiscate the caravan. And they went with large numbers, 313 people went out to somehow confront the caravan. So this is the same caravan. Now, the purpose of all these small excursions was to show the presence of Muslims on the way of the business caravan and to discourage them from any thought of assaults, which of course was always in the mind of people of Mecca, that one day we have to come and finish the job in Medina. Then there was Ghazwatu Safwan, or Badrul Ula. Now, this was a different type of Ghazwa. It was actually a police excursion, or somehow a policing of Medina, because someone by the name Qurz ibn Jabir had plundered the herd outside Medina, and Prophet himself led a group of soldiers to follow him. Of course, he didn't find. He went on up to Safwan, and that was somewhere in Badr, and this is why it's called Badrul Ula. So we have two battles of Badr. The first is just an excursion or just following a culprit, and the second was the real Ghazwatu Badr, Battle of Badr. Unfortunately, this map that I have has not been printed nicely, because it's just a copy from the internet, and they don't come nicely in the copy. You see, this thicker line, or the line which is black actually, is the route, the ordinary route going to Syria. And, unfortunately you cannot see what is there, because you could see it very clearly on the monitor, but not here. It shows the place of Badr, and it shows the place of how far it's from Medina. However, on the other map, you could see where Badr is and where Khaybar is. Where is the other map? Yeah, Medina, you see Badr is just towards the south, towards the coast, and usually the caravans went just by the coast, going to Syria, and therefore Prophet wanted to intercept the caravan going towards the coast to that to this line actually, but they met with the army from Mecca in Badr. Prophet actually wanted to go further to intercept the caravan. Anyhow, there was also another Sariya. Sariya of Abdullah ibn Jahsh, which actually caused lots of trouble for prophets. Usually people who decide for themselves cause problems. And this Abdullah ibn Jahsh decided for himself what he wanted to do, and it really, really caused trouble for prophets. Now, how did it cause trouble? Prophet actually wanted somehow to find out, to inspect the movement of people of Mecca and their caravans, even towards the south, even the caravans which were going to Yemen. I actually wanted to say that we are present everywhere, so you better somehow soften your stance against us. So he sent only 10 men. This Sariya was comprised of only 10 men, 10 or 11 men, under the leadership of Abdullah ibn Jahsh. Now, he sent Abdullah ibn Jahsh, he gave him a letter, and now we come to the shrewd type of tactics of the Prophet. He didn't say where you are going, he said, you go towards Mecca, after 2 days you go, open my letter. And in that letter I have given you instructions what to do. So, why did Prophet do that? Anyone can think of anything? Why Prophet, for example, sends a group of people, he says go towards Mecca, and he doesn't order them anything. He says, I have written my orders and instructions in a letter, go and after 2 days open it.
I think they would do it.
No, they certainly did it. They were mu'minun, of course. They certainly did it. He actually didn't want people of Medina, among whom there were many agents of Mecca, to know where these troops are going. And also, this was one of the most dangerous missions given to a group. So Prophet didn't want to dishearten them right at the beginning. So he said, you open the letter, then you ask the men who are with you whether they want to come with you or not. If they don't want to come with you, send them back. Now, he went, after 2 days they traveled, they went and he opened the letter, and the letter was, you go to towards Mecca, a place between Ta'if and Mecca. I forgot the name of that place. Anyhow, not a very important place. Somewhere between Ta'if and Mecca, you stay there and detect the movement of caravans of Ta'if which commute between Ta'if and Mecca. So the Prophet wanted to know when these caravans are moving, and also if you want to show yourself, that's fine. Of course, it was very dangerous. There were only 10 people. So they went there, and they stayed to detect. They saw caravans coming and going. However, this Abdullah ibn Jahsh was a very tough man, and all his wealth, all his property was confiscated in Mecca. So he said, I am going to teach these people a lesson. Now, the caravan which is going, I'm going to teach them a lesson. And of course, all the 10 men who were accompanying him, they said, no, we are coming, of course, we are seeking Shahada, we come with you. They went there. On the way, two of them, one Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas and one other companion, they lost their camels, they went after them, they were arrested, taken to Mecca. This was the fate of two. There was a setback right at the beginning. So, a caravan came with lots of guards. Abdullah ibn Jahsh said, we attack them. And of course, they were very, very brave people, not thinking about anything. Sometimes in Iran-Iraq war, we had some scenes that, for example, a boy of 15 had captured 16 Iraqi soldiers and bringing back with one Kalashnikov or something like that, without having any fear of anything. I know these people were just like that. So they fought, they actually killed one of them, and they confiscated the whole caravan. They captured two of them and brought everything to Mecca with success and victory. Now we have brought everything. This is the booties of war to Medina, sorry. Go to Medina, these are the booties of war. What? Did I tell you to do this? Well, they were there, these are filthy people. We didn't, of course, we had to fight them. Well, it was okay. But, you know when they did it? On the last day of Rajab. Well, Rajab is a month, is Shahrul Haram, isn't it? Fighting in Rajab was appalling. I mean, when, of course, anyone heard that companions of the Prophet have attacked a caravan in month of Rajab, in Shahrul Haram. So, what happened? Everyone started to talk. Abdullah ibn Jahsh was a relative of the Prophet as well, brother of Zainab bin Jahsh. And companions of the Prophet, they have attacked in the month of Haram. The Jews started to talk against it. Muslims started to talk against it. Munafiqun started to talk. People of Mecca started to talk against it. And Prophet was very ashamed. Because in a way, this was one of the values that Prophet was promoting. So, Abdullah ibn Jahsh and the four other companions became very ashamed, not talking to anyone, isolated. Prophet did not touch the booties because he said, I don't know what to do with these. These are captured in the month of Haram, whether I have to return it to them or what, until these verses were revealed. Now, these are, of course, you cannot understand the full meaning of these verses, unless you know what was the occasion in which the verses were revealed. يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الشَّهْرِ الْحَرَامِ. Of course, there is a verse at the beginning, كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الْقِتَالُ وَهُوَ كُرْهٌ لَكُمْ. This is one of the first verses which was revealed about fighting, that fighting is written on you, and you don't like it, you dislike it, and maybe you dislike something is better for you. Now, the most important thing is the middle verse, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الشَّهْرِ الْحَرَامِ قِتَالٍ فِيهِ. They ask you concerning the sacred month about fighting in it. Is it not illegal to fight? Is it not abhorrent to fight in Shahrul Haram? Say, yes, fighting in it is a grave matter. And hindering men from Allah's way, it is hindering, of course, men from Allah's way mean those who come for Hajj. Because Rajab is month of Umrah, Zilqa'dah, Zilhajjah, and Muharram are the months of Hajj. And that's why they were Shahrul Haram. So it is قُلْ قِتَالٌ فِيهِ كَبِيرٌ وَشَدٌ عَنْ سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ. If you start fighting in Shahrul Haram, then you obstruct people coming to Hajj. وَكُفْرٌ بِهِ. And it is kufr, it is disbelief in Allah, denying Him, and hindering men from the sacred mosque and turning its people out of it. There's something wrong with this translation. وَإِخْرَاجُ أَهْلِهِ مِنْهُ أَكْبَرُ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. Now, Allah says, I accept. It's very great, it's very bad. Fighting in Shahrul Haram, it would obstruct Hujjaj. However, وَإِخْرَاجُ أَهْلِهِ مِنْهُ أَكْبَرُ. Expelling the people of Haram out of Haram is even worse, more abhorrent. That's what the kuffar were doing. وَالْفِتْنَةُ أَكْبَرُ مِنَ الْغَاتِ. And the fitna, the discord that you have created by punishing and torturing the people is even worse than killing and fighting. So, then it said, of course, these kuffar are going to fight you. In a way, Allah said, okay, it doesn't matter, they made a mistake. Don't do it again. And then the following verse, which is very important, and relieved Abdullah ibn Jahsh and others who were with him and the Prophet, is very, very important. إِنَّ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا والذين هاجروا وجاهدوا في سبيل الله, those who believed and migrated and fought in the way of Allah, أولئك يرجون رحمة الله, they are expecting رحمة الله. In a way it says that Abdullah and others, you are expecting my mercy, do not worry. However, of course, as I said, doing things on one's own accord created this lot of problem for the Prophet. Of course, then the Kuffar of Mecca came, they wanted their two people back, the Prophet said, okay, you release our men, we release your men, and the thing ended actually peacefully. Now, there were other incidents before the Battle of Badr, because the Battle of Badr is a remarkable event after the migration. So we say we can actually categorize those events which took place before the Battle of Badr and those that took place after the Battle of Badr. Well, the first thing was marriage with Aisha, which took place in the first year after Hijrah. Of course, Prophet had already married Sauda in Mecca, and Sauda migrated to Medina after Khadija. Had migrated to Mecca, and then Prophet married Aisha in the first year. Then there was, in the first year, the death of Abu Umama. You remember Abu Umama, the man who converted the whole Medina into Islam, As'ad ibn Zurara, who went to Mecca, and he was advised, put some cotton in your ear so that you don't hear what Prophet said. He died because he was very old. He died in the first year. And according to some reports, he was the first person buried in Baqi. Because, of course, there was another cemetery in Medina. Prophet did not bury any of his companions in the old cemetery. He chose Baqi as a place and as a place of for graveyard, and the first man died and buried there was As'ad ibn Zurara. According to some others, he was Uthman ibn Maz'un, a friend of Prophet, one of the Muhajirun, who also died in the first or second year. Death of Walid ibn Mughayra in Mecca. Of course, this was a great thing because it was a relief for everyone, because this man was one of those men about whom many surahs and verses were revealed, and the man who actually tested the Prophet and said that this is a sahir, this is a magician who puts his charm on people. And in surah Qalam or what? Sanasimuhu ala al-khurtum. We will mark him on his forehead or on nose. Now, then came the change of Qibla in Rajab, 17 months after Hijrah. Now, this was a big blow to Jews, of course, because up till now the Jews thought that, okay, this Prophet, whatever he does, his praying was Baytul Muqaddas, towards Jerusalem. And we are praying towards Jerusalem as well. And the type of provocations that Jews made during these 17 months after migration really make Prophet very, very unhappy. And how they talked, how they behaved. So Prophet really, really wished that Allah would change the matter. He didn't like, he became to that sort of attitude that he didn't want to pray in the direction where the Jews were praying. And that's why the Quran says, of course Prophet didn't feel comfortable to say it, to ask, but sometimes he just looked up at this guy, that God, how, for example, just thinking how good it would have been if you changed my Qibla. And then Allah says, قَدْ نَرَى تَقَلُّبَ وَجْهَكَ فِي السَّمَاءِ, indeed we see the turning of your face towards the sky, to the heavens, so we shall surely turn you to a Qibla which you shall like. And then the order, turn then your face towards the sacred mosque, Masjid al-Haram, and wherever you are, turn your faces towards it. And those who have been given the book most surely know that it is the truth from their Lord, and Allah is not at all heedless of what they do. And Of course, then lots of polemical, theological issues raised by Jews, for example. Well, what type of prophet is he? He cannot decide which direction he wants to pray. Or, for example, what happens to the prayers that you had performed before? If they were right, this one is wrong. If this one is right, they were wrong. I mean, all these silly type of arguments which happened certainly after this. And that's why Allah says, we want to test the degree of your faith. This also happened. It happened, it is said that you have, of course, been to Masjid al-Qiblatain. This is outside Medina, of course. It was a mosque for Bani Salim ibn Auf, a tribe who were living outside Medina. Probably, it's not, of course, definitive, but probably Prophet was invited to that mosque for some reason, because someone had passed away or something, and he was praying Salatul Zuhr there when, of course, the Jibreel came and turned him. And they say that he prayed two rak'ahs of Zuhr, and then Jibreel turned him towards Mecca, and that's why it's called Masjid al-Qiblatain. In other reports we have that no, Prophet was not there actually. The news of the change of Qibla came to that mosque when they were praying Zuhr, and someone came and just turned the Imam, saying that, oh, it means that, well, the Qibla is changed, and that's why it's called Masjid al-Qiblatain. But that's very, very improbable. Most probably Prophet was there and he was praying, and Jibreel actually turned him, told him that he has to turn. The other incidents were injunctions to fast, to pay zakat, Salatul Eid, anything you find in Surah Al-Baqarah. Actually, Surah Al-Baqarah is the history of the first and second year in Medina. So anything you find in Surah Al-Baqarah, almost anything you find in Surah Al-Baqarah is revealed in the first and second year of Hijrah. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ. However, there is one verse, for example, which is revealed in the fifth year, placed just after the verse which was revealed in the second year, in Surah Baqarah. And this was because, of course, Prophet knew that where these verses should be placed. And Prophet ordered that you have to place this first in such a place. Now, in the second year, it was revealed that all you who believe, fasting is prescribed for you, as it was prescribed for those before you, so that you may guard against evil. The month of Ramadan is that in which the Quran was revealed, a guidance to men. And what's important about it is that, and you should complete the number. That means that I want you to complete 30 days. And even if you are not present in Ramadan, if you are not in your city, you do qada for it later on. وَلِتُكْمِلُ الْأَدَّةِ, so that you complete the number. That number was very important. Then, in the fifth year, this is interesting, it is revealed that it is made lawful to you to go to your wives on the night of the fast. They are an apparel for you and you are an apparel for them. Allah knew that you acted unfaithfully to yourself, so He has turned to you mercifully. Now, actually the injunction of fast was that during the whole month of Ramadan, wife and husband could not join together, could not go together, even during the night. And this was, of course, very hard. There was another thing, and that was you could not eat anything after you sleep, after Maghrib. So you go home, it's just half an hour to Maghrib, you are very tired, you fall asleep. After Maghrib you wake up, you cannot eat anything. It meant that you only eat while you are awake. Now, even if after iftar, for example, you sleep, you couldn't eat suhoor. You should have waited until. That's what, because Allah wanted the night of Ramadan to be honored and to be a night of worship. That meant that during the day you should have some rest and during the night you should be awake. Otherwise you cannot eat after you sleep. Now this verse, which was revealed in the fifth year, actually repeals the whole thing. It says, first of all, that it has been made lawful for you now, and because Allah knew that most of you violate this. You cannot be faithful to yourself. So he has turned to you mercifully and removed from you this burden. Second, so now be in contact with them and seek what Allah has ordained for you, and eat and drink until حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَكُمُ الْحَيْثُ الْأَبْيَضُ مِنَ الْحَيْثِ الْأَسْوَدُ مِنَ الْفَجْرِ until you see the white coat distinguished from the black coat. That's Fajr, of course, until Fajr. So it means you can now eat, whether you sleep, you don't sleep, you can now eat whatever you want. Good luck that we weren't in those 2 years. It would have been very difficult to fast, actually. Now, other incidents before the Battle of Badr. Again, the injunction to fight against Surah Al-Baqarah. As I said, Surah Al-Baqarah is the history of that time. Of course, sorry, this is Surah Hajj. The other verse, كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الْقِتَالُ, was in Surah Baqarah. أُذِنَ لِلَّذِينَ يُقَاتَلُونَ بَأَنَّهُمْ ظُلِمُوا وَإِنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَى نَصْرِهِمْ لَقَدِيرٌ. Permission to fight is given to those upon whom war is made because they are oppressed, and most surely Allah is well able to assist them. Those who have been expelled from their homes without a just cause, except that they say our Lord is Allah. And had there not been Allah's repelling some people by others, certainly there would have been pulled down cloisters and churches and synagogues and mosques in which Allah's name is much remembered. The other thing, completing the Quba Mosque. You remember we said on his way to Medina, Prophet just laid the foundations of Quba Mosque. Now, people of Quba didn't want to finish that themselves because they wanted that to be blessed by the Prophet. And that's why the mosque is very important. And they said, "La masjidun usisa ala taqwa min awwal yawm ahqqa an taquma fi." So they just left it so that Prophet would find time to come and finish it. However, Prophet didn't find time until after the injunction about the change of Qibla came. So Prophet went and changed the whole foundation towards Qibla, towards the new Qibla, and then completed it. And he said that, I don't know how true that would be, because it's very difficult. Prophet liked Quba very much. They say that every Saturday Prophet walked from Medina to Quba to do Salat al-Zuhr there, and then go back. For people of Quba. Maybe, probably these people of Quba at that time were really, really pious people. And that's why their mosque is praised so much in the Quran. Then the other incident was the marriage of Ali and Fatima, peace be on them, which took place in the second year of Hijrah. About the age of Fatima, there is always this dispute, whether she was born 5 years after Ba'tha or 5 years before Ba'tha. If she was born 5 years after Ba'tha, that means at this year she should have been 10 years old. If she was born 5 years before Ba'tha, that means that she should have been born she should have been 20 years by now. And 20 years is the view accepted by almost the all or overwhelming majority of Sunni scholars. 10 years, that's 5 years after Ba'tha, is what is reported by our A'imma and accepted by overwhelming majority of Shi'i scholars. Now, which one do you prefer? Well, that's not a matter of our preference, isn't it? It's history. But there are points that undermine the Sunni view about it. First of all, it was not common to leave a girl to reach the age of 20 before they married. And it was very, very unusual. And therefore, it's more probable that, yes, she was at the age of 10, as any other girl would have married at that age. Now, Sunni scholars mostly have actually preferred the view of 20 years because they have some reports that Fatima was very ugly and no one wanted to marry her. And that's why she was somehow kept until the age of 20. No one wanted to marry her. and that's why Ali volunteered to marry Fatima. Very funny things, of course, because in all histories we have that Fatima had lots of what do you call it? Wooers? Suitors. Yeah. Lots of suitors. And she, including Abu Bakr and Umar, including them, because it was great honor. Everyone knew how Fatima was loved by the Prophet. I mean, the way Prophet treated peace on her, treated Fatima, actually encouraged everyone to somehow try their chance to see if Prophet would agree Fatima to marry them. And it's reported that it became a matter of surprise for everyone that why Prophet peace, because about his other daughters, she did not reject anyone. I mean, before Ba'tha, after Ba'tha, she did not reject anyone. She just, anyone came first and asked for marriage, she agreed. About Fatima, that persistence in rejection of all the Muhajirun, because almost all of them came and asked for the hand of Fatima, it was very amazing. So, Abu Bakr and Umar, it's reported that they actually guessed what's going on. And one day they said that, we believe that Prophet is keeping Fatima for Ali. Well, of course, how do you know? Are you sure? Well, let's try. So they went to Ali. He was working outside Medina, planting some palm trees, and said, don't you want to marry? He said, yes, I want. Who you want to marry? He didn't say anything. You want to marry Fatima? Peace be on her. Yes, I want. And they said, so why don't you go to Prophet and ask for her hand? It's reported that just at that moment, Ali put everything down and went. Right, because he did not actually have the courage to go. He felt very embarrassed going and asking the Prophet. And the Hadith says that he went to the Prophet's house, and Prophet just saw he was reddened in a way that's so embarrassed. And he didn't say anything. And Prophet said, why have you come here, Ali? He just cast his eyes down. He said, have you come to ask for Fatima's hand? And Ali said, yes. And Prophet said, "That okay, what do you have? I mean, this was completely different from other companions, of course. What do you have? He said, I have nothing. I have a horse, a sword, a shield, and a camel by which I take water for poultry. Prophet said, the camel you need because of your work. The sword you need for battles, the horse you need, the shield you don't need. Because you don't need a shield in the battle. No, of course, that was Ali. He didn't need a shield. So go and sell your shield and bring the money. So he went, and the shield was about 480 dirham. Not, of course, very considerable amount of money. He brought it, and Prophet asked Miqdad to go and buy some sort of house furniture, like mattress and other things. And immediately the marriage was concluded, and everyone actually, not everyone, most of those who had asked for Fatima's hand before came and asked the Prophet that why you rejected us. And the Prophet said, it was not my decision. Allah had actually ordered me to make this marriage. And of course, Prophet knew the value of Fatima and the value of Ali, and so it was a perfect match. I said that Ali, peace be on him, felt very embarrassed actually to go and ask the Prophet. This was the case even when they wanted to consummate the marriage. For a long time Ali didn't go and ask, didn't go to the house of Prophet at all after that, after the marriage was concluded, until Umm Salama told him, why don't you go and take your wife? And he said, well, I think so, to say to the Prophet that I want to take my wife. And then Umm Salama said, do you really want to take your wife? He said, yes, of course I want. And she said, okay, I'll go and talk to the Prophet to arrange everything for you. And, well, of course, this shows the attitude of Ali, peace be on him, and the type of character that he had. Now, we come to the Battle of Badr. Now, this Battle of Badr, of course, is the decisive battle of Islam. I cannot, of course, elaborate on it tonight, but I don't know, we have two more sessions, or three more sessions, and if I want to go with these details, we cannot cover the rest of the life of the Prophet. We have two choices, either continue with this detail and just stop where we finish, where our time is finished, or just sacrifice the details and go very quickly to finish.
Yes. Let's just follow the sunnah of Musa and add an extra...
Mm-hmm. Extra 10 days. Well, of course, they have deadlines to meet, so...
They don't have to come.
Anyhow, so Hel will talk about it and then we decide what to do, whether we just rush it through to cover the next of the life of the Prophet, or we just end with a happy ending, like for example Hudaybiyah or something like that. Now, the Battle of Badr happened, as I said, there was that excursion of Ushayra where Prophet went. The caravan was moving up towards Syria. When the caravan came back, now Prophet of course came out with full force. Never such a force was mustered by the Prophet to go to any caravan. So here Prophet was decisive that he wanted to fight the guards of the caravan, who were about 200-300 people, and to confiscate the caravan. The permission was given to the Prophet to do that. Now, of course, Abu Sufyan was a very shrewd man. He, after, of course, on his way out, he saw that Prophet had come. Coming back, he was very cautious. He was asking at every way station, what's happening, who's doing what's happening in Medina, and he had the information that, yes, Prophet has moved out of Medina with a force of about 300 men. And he changed his way, he lingered sometimes, so that the Prophet could not meet with the caravan. Now, with the tactics that he had, somehow he managed to escape from being intercepted by the Prophet. However, before that, he sent someone called Zamzam, not Zamzam, Zamzam with Ra, to Mecca. Go and tell them if you want your property, do something because Muhammad is out to confiscate everything. And of course, that was a huge caravan. That's why it was led by Abu Sufyan. Abu Sufyan usually himself didn't lead any caravan. There was lots of property in it. And everyone in Mecca had some property in that caravan. So, when Zamzam came and said that the caravan is going to be looted, everyone was shaken. And the way he came to the city is very interesting, because he cut the nose of his camel, showing that this is the end of the world. And he torn his dress, coming into the city, shouting, "Help, help, the caravan is being looted." So the whole people of Medina were roused. We have to do something. So they actually mobilized a force for battle, for fight. They mobilized the force. Now, I have given a comparison between the force... Yeah, to Mecca. I always mistake between Mecca and Medina anyhow. The Muslims were 313 men. The Kuffar were 950 men. It's interesting how the Muslims lived in Medina at that time, because they had only 3 horses to take with them, and the Kuffar had 200 horses, the horsemen of course. 70 camels they had, because camels were actually their armored vehicles. They somehow traveled on camels. But 313 people had only 70 camels. That meant that every 3 or 4 or 5 people should have somehow ride these camels in turn. And he said that Hamza, Ali ibn Abi Talib, the Prophet and someone else shared one camel to ride in turn to come to Badr. Kuffar had 700 camels. And amazingly, they didn't have swords, because usually, especially the fight between Aws and Khazraj, it was all with spears and stuff and something like that. They didn't fight with swords. And they had only 7 swords with them. And of course, all men fully armed in the other army. Now, when the news of the army dispatch reached the Prophet, then everything, the whole picture was changed. The Prophet had not come to fight. He had come to confiscate the caravan. 200 guards, they could very easily fight. Now the news has come that a full army is coming from Mecca. What to do? What to do? Whether we go ahead and fight or not? Now, before going out, Prophet had said, or maybe just on the way, a verse revealed. وَإِذْ يَعِدُكُمُ اللَّهُ إِحْدَى الطَّائِفَتَيْنِ يَكُونُ لَكُمْ Allah had promised you that one of the two groups, either the caravan or the army, will be yours. That means you will defeat and take booties from it. And of course, you thought that, well, how could we defeat this army? So it's certainly the caravan. وَتَوَدُّونَ أَنَّ غَيْرَ ذَاتِ الشَّوْكَةِ تَكُونُ لَكُمْ And you like that the not armed group, that is showcase armor. So you would have liked that not the not armed group were yours, but Allah had destined something else. Now, when the army moved out of Mecca, Abu Sufyan had already escaped the Prophet. So he sent a messenger that we are now safe, don't come. However, Abu Jahl and others said, this is now the time. Why should we go back? We have the army mobilized. We are out of Mecca. We are on our way to Medina. We just finish everything. There is no one in Medina who can fight us. So, despite the repetitive demand of Abu Sufyan, that don't come, we don't want to fight with these people, they are very dangerous, they did not listen. They said, no, we go. Even if we don't fight, we go to Badr, we just dance and celebrate so that the Muslims see our power and we come back. Now, of course, this was their position. Prophet was in a very difficult position. Because the difficult position was two things. First of all, these people were not prepared for war. They had come out, I mean, bringing 7 swords tell you everything. They had come out just to take the caravan. Now, there is war. So, Prophet stopped at a place called Zafran, or Zafran, and he consulted the companions. What should we do? The caravan is gone. An army is coming. Should we fight, or we should not fight? Now, most of the Muhajirun said, we should not fight. Including, it's reported from Abu Bakr and Umar, saying that إنها قريش وخيلاؤها ما آمنت منذ كفرت ولا ذلت منذ عزت ولم نخرج على أحبة الحرب. It is Quraysh and its arrogance which has come out. They have not believed since they disbelieved and have not humiliated since they are dignified. It means that they are not defeated in any battle. How are we going to fight them? And we have not come out prepared for war. This was. Some others, like Miqdad and others, said, no, why should we worry? They are more in number, we shouldn't worry. And we go to war. Many of Muhajirun started to speak like that, but Prophet didn't want them to speak. Prophet wanted the Ansar to speak. Why? Anyone knows why? And if Ansar disagreed to go to war, Prophet didn't go to war. Muhajirun, of course, Prophet was one of the Muhajirun himself. Yes?
Because the Muhajirun would have fought for the Prophet, the Ansar would have fought for Islam.
Not even Muhajirun, many of them fought for Islam, of course. Now, the reason is that in the treaty of Aqaba that Prophet made with the Ansar, there was no mention of war like this. It was only protection. If Prophet was attacked, they protected him. Okay? So, Prophet didn't want to violate that treaty. So, there he stopped. And after Muhajirun spoke, he said, I want to hear from Ansar. What to do? And Sa'd ibn Ubadah and other of Ansar, they stood up and they said, although our treaty is short of such battle, because we did not make a treaty to fight, and initially, our treaty was just to protect you if you are attacked. However, now that you are Muslim, now that you are the Prophet of God, we follow whatever you say. And all of the Ansar unanimously, they said that we want to go to battle. And that is how they went to battle. Sometimes, it's very disheartening, because sometimes Sunnis or even some Shias, they think that we disregard the sacrifice that Muhajirun and Ansar made, and we somehow disrespect the companions of the Prophet. But the point is that there were only a handful of these companions who somehow after the Prophet were failed in the trials of the time. Most of them, these people who fought, they are very, very respectable people. And they are the people that we have to praise them, pray for them all the time. As Imam Zainul Abidin in Isaifa Sajjadiyya prays for them and praises them. And they were always with the right people. Just, I have mentioned this in the Nahjul Balagha lectures, that in Sassin, in the Battle of Sassin, there were about 18,000 of Muhajirun and Ansar on the side of Ali ibn Abi Talib, and less than 18 of them on the side of Muawiyah. So you see how, of course, they could distinguish between Haq and Batil. And, of course, these things that one hears, how they sacrifice, would really brings about a sense of appreciation of what the companions of the Prophet really did. Okay, the very battle itself, I leave it for next week, inshallah.